Hello, I'm Greg Johnston, and welcome to Imagining the Past. This series of podcasts were culled from sessions held during the 2019 Historical Novel Society Australasia Conference, held at the Parramatta campus of Western Sydney University on the 26th and 27th of October, 2019. The podcasts were made from live microphone feeds. This session was called Walking Side by Side, Collaborations Between Historical Novelists and Historians. Parramatta, the home of the 2019 conference, was the second penal settlement established in Australia when Thomas Keneally and Meg Keneally decided to set their Montserrat detective series there. Meg sought the assistance of local historian Gay Hendrickson to dig into the township's history. Gillian Pollock learns how Meg and Gay formed a working relationship to trace the footsteps of Keneally's characters, locate potential murder sites, and pore over history together, and how their collaborations extended to Meg's first solo novel, Fled.
My first question to both of you is, in terms of writing about people, there are a whole bunch of major moments, and your novels are about major moments. Fled is about a particular major moment. And even when you're talking about the Montserrat stuff, it's dividing history into this moment and that moment. But what holds them together are people and places, and we're in one of those places. This is Parramatta. This floor is not, but the under the floor maybe. I'm sorry, it's late in the conference and you're going to get a lot of very bad jokes. And I was thinking, it's about time we talked about Parramatta, and both of you have views and historical knowledge and stories. Could you tell us about the people and the place?
Well, if we look at it through the lens of how Gay and I came to meet. I've always been interested in the Parramatta Female Factory, which is probably, 5 minutes drive from here? Appalled that it is still not open to Australians as a historic site. My great-great-grandmother was there, and because I was writing a book about it, I got to stand in the room where she would have been assigned as a convict, which was a very emotional moment. But the other 1.7 million Australians descended from Parramatta Female Factory convicts don't have that opportunity. So I'm very passionate about that, as is Gay, who's the president of the Parramatta Female Factory Friends. And when we decided to set a murder mystery in the Parramatta Female Factory, Gay and I basically became joined at the hip for some months. Gay was incredibly, extraordinarily generous, very, very open, gave me as much information as I could ever ask. I was emailing her and calling her with all sorts of stupid questions all the time about what they would have eaten, what they would have worn, etc. And Gay was just basically my tour guide to that site in that particular time. And it even went down to one of the most helpful things. The murder at the centre of the book. Gay and I walked through the site and basically choreographed it. So we would be standing there, and I'd say, so there was a building there. If somebody on the second floor were to see the murder, where would the murder need to happen? And then if somebody on the second floor of this other building were to see the killer escaping, what kind of route would she take? And Gay stepped me through the whole lot, and we went through it all, and we walked around the site and then circled back, and Gay said, that means the murder needs to happen right here. And to have that experience of the site in the real world, as well as having been given so much amazing historical detail from Gay, was extraordinarily helpful.
Now, I'm curious, how does it feel from your end with the giving of all the detail?
Well, I have to say, at that moment in time, I suppose I'll start with this. Which one's the historian and which one's the writer? When you're standing in this spot and one's looking at all the facts and what is happening in that section, and the other one's going, I'm being this woman and I'm seeing what's happening out there because the creative spark has been passed over and you start to see it in a different way. And I really think I can't speak for other historians, but for me, the creativity of thinking is just as important in determining the history of things as well. And so for me, it was extraordinary. It was like a joint at the hip and sort of this flow of things through because you're really just trying to... None of us really know what actually happened, but we can guess things and we can look at the records. But the practical things can help fill out that imagination. And for me, it was really interesting. And there's real power in standing in those places, I think. Yeah.
The reason I smiled was you're the only other person today who said... We don't actually know what happened. Historians don't know what happened. Mm. Other people think historians know what happened. It's history is complex. And one of the complexities of history is that there's silencing. There's people who are standing on the edge, and that was Meg's phrase, I think.
It was Gay's phrase.
And there are people who are, what was the other one? Looking outside, looking in. So a lot of the history we have is recorded by people who aren't silenced, who aren't standing on the edge, and who aren't outside looking in. And both of you work against that in different ways. Can you talk about it with each other?
Yeah. Look, I might start with something that, you know, I've had an historian say to me about, you know, when you're looking at some of the convict women, for instance, and say, you know, well, it was better for them because they, you know, they came out here and they had a better life. But then when I've got ringing in my ears, Mary Hindle, one of the convict women going to the government saying, I implore you to release me from this hopeless slavery, you get a whole different sense of what it's like. And I think that those voices weren't heard at that time. You know, when I was curating the exhibition Women Transported, I found four images of convict women through the 50-odd years of that factory period. So four images and less than 15 objects in a national collection says we don't exist, we're not important.
Yeah, and
I mean, the treatment of the female factory convicts at the time when I was writing The Unmourned, there was another extraordinary story that you put me onto about a woman called Mary Ann Hamilton who had been... the superintendent would skim the rations of the women and sell them on. And so the women were starving. And this woman ate weeds and ate the feed of the geese, who clearly ate better than the women. For that, she was put in solitary confinement, tethered to the ground with stakes and ropes, and died of starvation. Where we come to your point about people being unheard is that there was an inquest into her death. And the inquest, not surprisingly, found she had died of hunger and hard treatment. And the administrative response to that was to increase the rations of the superintendent, not the women, because they thought, poor fella, he's probably hungry. If we give him more to eat, he won't steal from the...
Can I be currently political and say this is very familiar?
Yeah. So, I mean, these women really were no one. As far as the people who were in charge of administering them were concerned. And there was a quote at the time of the riot. I remember the Sydney Gazette referred to the riot that occurred today in 1827. The Sydney Gazette referred to the women as Amazonian banditti, which I think is a great phrase, but it also said something like the awful fact is that the fairer sex are far more obdurate in their crimes and determined in their vicious career than the men.
And they spread their pestilential influence throughout the colony.
Oh, pestilential influence, that's it. Yep.
And we've had phrases like that consistently for 100, 200, I can't count, 200 years now. It's the whole, Anne Summers has a whole list of phrases that she trots out, which are the same sort of things, which says something about the people who were silenced.
Yeah.
They're all people. We're all people. You don't become a non-person just because no one's listening.
Well, and you know, I think that it speaks to the strength of the people who were silenced, that they were able to get their voice heard to that extent. And the riot that happened today
is a prime example of people saying we won't be silenced.
Yes. We have in an earlier session, we have choice.
And I just love the descriptions of that riot. I love the fact that I don't like the, you know, moralising about it, but I love the fact that it happened.
And the fact that the women were put in a position where it was the only viable choice.
Yeah.
That was tough. I'm going to... That leads to a really good question. It happens to be the next question on my list, but... What's the role of the historical novelist then in relation to all of this?
Well,
can we get the historian to answer that first? Because I'm really curious.
Okay, I'll put a context on that. So I'm the historian who's talking yesterday to Meg and saying, Edward Rutherford, I love Edward Rutherford, I love Sharon Penman. One of the ways I understand history, thank you for anyone who writes historic fiction, is through walking around inside these novels and getting a sense of that, the time and the period. And I love historic fiction writers who do that historical research. And and the thoroughness of the research to me is being an historian. So I'm thinking that, you know, you're not... I don't think, you know, you can have this doubt between one and the other, whether you're a historian or the other. But I think that... The role of the historic fiction novel to me is really important to us in lots of ways. It comes of those things of, okay, what is the truth? What is the fact? What is imagination? Is imagination a kind of fact? So that's what I'm putting
it. It gives you a narrative, yes.
Yes, but narratives are soul things, aren't they? Isn't it? I love that Aristotle quote.
So it gives a story.
Yeah, that sense of, what is it? Memory is the scribe of the soul. Love it.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Chadwick said to me once, it puts the story back into history.
Thank you. Yes.
Sorry.
You know, one of the things that always amazes me is whenever I'm researching historical fiction, you come across these stories which you could never make up. You'd be accused of being fanciful if you made them up. Yet we don't tell them. They're not told in schools. They're not told in universities. They're not told in our public discourse. Why not? How hard do you have to try to make history boring, really? When there's so much interest in it, and I think that's part of the role of the historical fiction writer. We were discussing earlier amongst us a certain stoush between Inga Glendinnen and Kate Grenville, which we won't go into detail on due to lack of time. But there's plenty of information online if you haven't heard of it. Basically, on, you know, who owns history. My view is I'm not a historian, and I. Rely very heavily on historians in the work that I do. But one of the roles I think a historical novelist, if they're doing their job, has is to link people with the past through the emotional weight of what happened, through the feeling, to link people to the past through pulling out themes which still resonate today. You know, you might not be able to relate to a First Fleet convict who used to bail people up on the King's Highway in Cornwall and got transported for it. You can absolutely relate to a mother risking her life for her children. Yeah. You might not be able to relate to a gentleman convict serving out his time in Port Macquarie. You can absolutely relate to the idea of an unlikely friendship or the resonance of the wounds of the past. And that is, if a historical novelist is doing their job, that's what they're doing. They're drawing people into history and linking them through the emotional weight of those themes.
That's such a nice statement that I'm going to go straight to the audience for questions because, you know, there are some things that have to rest. You need to sit on them. I think that was such a beautiful... I want to finish there, but not finish completely. Open it up to the audience. Does anybody have any actual questions, not long dissertations, with a question mark at the end?
Maybe while the microphone's moving around to the first
question. You're allowed
question.
To put up your hands for questions.
Can I ask you a question and just put your hands up? Who feels like they're standing on the edge of the circle looking in when they're doing when they're living their lives? Do you feel like you've been the outsider? Put your hand up if you think feel like you have. Yeah, interesting.
And this is what novels Very are interesting. For. They yeah. make it's speaking as someone who's both historian and novelist. That's the transit point. That's where we can we can find a, oh, I'm there, I belong, I'm not just on the outside. It's one of the biggest, single biggest values that the novels have for us, is enabling us all to live in the society. Mm. Now we have a question up the front first.
Hello, I'm just wondering, some years ago there was a wonderful exhibition that you put on which was Silhouettes and Portraits of the Convict Woman, which I think it travelled around Australia. I was wondering what had happened to it, because it was, and you had a book that was printed from it, because I got that as well. Is that exhibition still going, and do you have any plans for anything similar?
I'm writing a fact book. it isn't anymore, but what I found extraordinary was actually a couple of things, and one's a little quirky, but the other not. You know, that when it went to places like Dubbo, we had 11,000 people going to it, 8,000 in Port Macquarie, 16,000 in Fremantle. Like, the enormous interest in that sort of personal connection that you're talking about. So it was really well responded to. But it was also, there was one of these women, and actually I will just say in a little aside, one of the writers here is a descendant of one of the women's portraits that went around.
Wow.
But she might say something in a little while. But there was also a woman called Constance de la Sablonnaire. Has anyone heard of her? Fabulous. Three quarters of the places I went around, a descendant came up and said, I know you. This is the someone who is recognised as a granddaughter of a French viscount, was the youngest female convict sent out, eight years old, speaking French, African slave to here. What a story.
Yeah. Mm.
Do you ever bring up something in research and say, I've got to find a novelist who'll write that for me?
So many stories.
I'm Gay's tame novelist.
In fact, we just had a funny thing, like, you know, you go from those stories and the Mary Hindle story, which that's another. There are so many. The stories of Elizabeth Browning Owen, who had four children, and then one was supposed to be left behind, and then she comes out here, and then they're all taken away, and then there's a whole other story. But, yeah, that's one of the reasons I think it works so well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, I'm about to do... shall I mention Charlotte Badger?
Well, that's what I was about to say too. Charlotte.
Yeah.
Charlotte.
There's another Parramatta female factory convict that I'm just about to start writing about.
Oh, somebody's heard of Charlotte.
So this relates to the answer. This is part of the answer to your question.
Oh, sorry, and I got so excited that I lost my mic. That wasn't a deliberate mic drop. Let me know if I'm holding this too close or whatever. I was talking about the stories that don't get told, and the vast majority of those stories are women's stories, and Gay was talking before about the paucity of artefacts and pictures and that sort of thing. Yet the women here in Australia were extraordinary. They were the ones that survived, the ones that were tough enough to survive, were just the most amazing creatures to me. There are people like Mary Reby, who's on your $20 note, who became one of the colony's leading entrepreneurs, having stolen a horse at the age of 14. And now she's made it onto the $20 note. By the way, on the $20 note, she's wearing a lace cap and spectacles, and she looks really sweet, as though she would bake cookies for you. I don't think anybody who did what she did could afford to be too sweet. I think she was probably a tough cookie herself. But that's what makes her so fascinating. And there's a story about that. I'm amazed that people don't know Mary Bryant's story, which is what Fled's about. But I'm even more amazed that they don't know the story of a woman called Charlotte Badger and her best friend Kitty Haggerty, who were Parramatta female factory convicts, who were transshipped to Van Diemen's Land as assigned servants. On a ship called the Venus. Now, you can't make this stuff up, as you will realise when you hear what happened aboard the Venus. The captain of the Venus was a sexual sadist who flogged the convict women for his own amusement.
Which he was not allowed to do.
Yeah, but there was no one there to stop him. And that's one of the other things that interests me about Australian colonial history, the distance and the fact that somebody could be an outright bastard and nobody could stop them. Charlotte, who's described in the historical record as corpulent and who had a little daughter, and Kitty, who's described as hoarse of voice and much inclined to smile. If I can't do something with that, I'm not trying, honestly. And their lovers. Kitty was involved with the first mate of the Venus, and Charlotte was involved with another convict, masterminded a mutiny. And they were successful in this mutiny. And they sailed the ship to the Bay of Islands in New Zealand, and Charlotte and Kitty became the first two European females in New Zealand. It's unclear and a matter of some debate what happened after that. Kitty sadly died. Charlotte may have gone to Tonga. She may have gone to America. She may have come back here. But I haven't quite decided which my fictional character based on her will do yet. But the fact that this occurred and that nobody knows about it is, to me, is extraordinary.
I've heard about them as the first two European females in
New Zealand.
In New Zealand, because New Zealanders talk about that. I didn't know the rest of
the backstory.
Yes.
and while he decided to go whaling too, and he left them on an island for 15 days.
Yes.
Molly Morgan's the other one.
And this is why I write science fiction. It's easier to believe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good question.
The captain came back and wrote an account depicting Charlotte and Kitty as, of course, you know, it was very easy if a man in power in a position of authority didn't like a particular woman, he'd just say she was a whore.
Yep.
You know, they're all whores. That was the general attitude. Mm. So he depicted them as drunken whores who were, out of control. Me, no, Your Honour, I never laid a finger on them. So... yeah, it was a very self-serving account.
Now, we had another question. Someone was behind you. Behind you sounds like a pantomime.
He's behind you.
You mentioned that today there was a riot.
Yes,
on
Parramatta
Female
Act. Today's
day. I grew up in Carlingford. I don't know anything about it. Can you just tell me what happened?
Well, I might hand over to Gay because she's the historian.
And let me tell you a story. okay, so it does go back to Mary Ann Hamilton. So go 12 months before today, if we're in 1827 right now. And what happens is the women are being treated badly. And let's not just say the women, because there'd be 90 to 150 children easily at the same time in that place. They're not getting enough food. Mary Ann Hamilton dies of starvation. And then there's an inquiry that says that there's not enough food, there's no fresh water, there's not enough clothing for these women, and it has to be rectified. Then you get about the following sort of 10 months or so is rising unrest within the factory, you know, assaulting the visiting surgeon, for instance, assaulting the matron just before she goes. So you get this sort of rise of things happening. So we go to last Monday and the women in the third class start to get very dissatisfied. And on the Tuesday, 14 of them put down their tools and say, we're not going to do any more work until you improve our conditions. And then what happens is that the matron of the time decides to cut their rations. Just the tea and sugar, but you cut my tea and sugar on.
I'd riot.
Yeah, exactly. So she cuts it. But because of all that treatment beforehand, what's happened is that the women in the third class throw out the constables and they take over the third class. But this passes around further. We go another couple of days, we get an assault on the retiring matron. Then the new matron, Matron Gordon, starts, and because the previous matron, Matron Rain, had been assaulted the night before, what she does is reduce the rations again. And so the women are about to write, and somehow she talks them back And the women insist that if you don't feed us, if you don't do something about our conditions, then we will riot. And that's what they did. They broke down the gates, over 100. And so this is where you get the Amazonian banditti are going through the town. There's 40 sergeants, and very amusing story, 40 sergeants running in all directions with their bayonets. 40 sergeants with bayonets. What are they going to do? If you can't quell the women, you're going to kill the women. But what happened was they were hungry. So the reports are about the bakers and the people who got food throwing food out into the streets and the women picking it up and putting it in their aprons. And so most of them were enticed back. And this is where, you know, we talk about our identity as women. It took them a couple of months to get all of them back, but most of them came back. And they're saying, who are the ringleaders? And the women stand together and they say, because we want to punish them. This is me sort of paraphrasing. And what the women say is, you punish one of us, you punish all of us. You know, if that's not mateship, I don't know what is. That's the kind of thing that happened. And then after the riot, they did get their rations back, and so they did go back to work. But you're still getting other things happening, like one of the leaders, a month on bread and water. So that's the short version.
But mark this date next year for whatever the Saturday closest to the 27th is, for riot day at Parramatta Female Factory.
We've got not enough people to riot, I'm afraid. But there's a wonderful, yes, why don't we celebrate things like this? Because that was a bunch of women saying, all we want is something basic, we're going to do something quite dangerous together.
Yeah. And I mean, Gay is the one who's responsible for... Oh, sorry. Gay is the one who's responsible for commemorating this riot every year. And, you know, I was talking before about how the Parramatta Female Factory site is off limits to people most of the time, but on riot day you can go and see it. So, you know, if you can get out there next year, definitely worth doing.
I think we're incredibly lucky that we've got this panel with Gay today, to be honest.
Yes, likewise.
And I love every historic fiction. Basically, you go to the league. Everyone know where the Leagues Club is? If you don't, you just go head north along O'Connell, take the next street past the Leagues Club, and it's in there. And we're talking 1818, you know, so we all know Hyde Park Barracks and how to get there. Yeah, sister site, 1 year later.
Designed by Greenway.
Which means perfectly beautiful to look at and very depressing to think about. Mm.
But great stories as well. Molly Morgan, that's another one.
So, do you think about how much those women must have had in common apart from everything else, and that sort of solidarity?
Absolutely.
And you think about the term mateship, which is associated with men. Well, maybe it needs to start back in the female factory.
Yeah, and one of the things that draws me to Charlotte Badger's story is her friendship with Kitty Haggerty, and that's what I really want to explore in the book, because I do think while women's history has been undertold, those female relationships have also been undertold as well, and they are so. If we think about our own lives, you know, we have a variety of relationships which are hugely important. My female friendships are massively important to me and a part of who I am. So why wouldn't we highlight those in fiction or in historical research?
Now, I'm going to ask, several of you have had questions, but there have been people who have been really silent who had hands up at the beginning. Yes.
And I know you said no dissertations, but I just want to quickly read something that Margaret Atwood wrote about history. Which I did actually have as part of an exegesis that I did. She said, "The past no longer belongs only to those who once lived in it. The past belongs to those who claim it and are willing to explore it and to infuse it with meaning for those alive today."
I love that quote, and I'm a huge fan of Margaret Atwood. And I do think that the past belongs to everyone, and while I sort of, you know... historians are massively important. I couldn't do what I do without them. But no one owns history. Or rather, those who are willing to lay claim to it own it. We all own it if we've got the interest and the
the wherewithal to research it. And people sometimes say to me, why does history really matter? Why do you bother writing about the past? Don't we have enough pressing concerns at the present? And after I've finished fluffing up my feathers like an indignant cockatoo, I tell them how history of the past is part of who we are now. It's not something discrete that you can draw a line under and wrap in grease paper and pop in the biscuit tin on the shelf. It's not some sort of sepia-toned, quaint little thing. It is reverberating now. And that came home to me, for example, very much while I was writing Fled, because I was writing about the day everything changed for the first Australians and they are still feeling the ripples of that. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but if you want a short answer, I'm not the right person.
You can't answer quotes by Margaret Atwood. It's not without long-winded answers.
Yeah, this is very true, and thank you for that quote. I love it.
And so I'm probably going to say exactly what she said.
Okay, that's a way of answering Margaret Atwood.
Yeah. But with another quote, so I think of an early novel by Kate Grenfell, Joan Makes History, which I know is aimed at a young women's audience. But at the end of it, she says, "There's nothing I've felt that some Joan has not felt before me, and there's nothing I've done that some Joan has not done before me. You may not think so to look at me, but I'm the whole of history walking down the street." Mm-hmm. And aren't we?
Yeah.
And that makes it relevant today. You know, what's brought me to sitting here with you? Then I think the other thing is, you know, I've read some of the stories of you know, whatever the history is, whether it's, you know, relating to one of the daughter of the MacArthurs where dad's making all the decisions about the marriage, or whether it's about, you know, some of the women's stories where they are actually political refugees. You know, someone's done something that doesn't fit with the British government and they're sent out here, and then I'm reading a refugee story that's current, people being sent out here, and then you look at the experiences and how they're responding. It's time, but it's the same thing, and it's like the women's experiences. How can you leave two children in another country never to see them again?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point too, because there's a similarity as well in the demonisation of, say, the Parramatta female factory rebels in the press and the demonisation of asylum seekers today.
There's a cultural consistency. We have a deep culture as well as a surface culture. Mm. And when things repeat and repeat and repeat, it means that there's something holding them into our culture.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the women's children were taken away from them, and as soon as they were weaned or reached the age of three, they were removed from their parental influence. So that's the other thing they had to deal with. But they found ways around it too. That was in one part of that period.
Helen Leonard, who was very senior for a long while in Australian feminist circles, said that women needed to become stroppy. And I suspect that the question is whether we're paying attention to women who have always been stroppy.
Mm, yeah, that's right.
Recognising our free will, you know, that we are making our choices and it's our time to make the choices.
It's everybody's time. This is the thing. We are all... Look around, we're all human beings. Well, I'm not sure about that chair.
Sorry.
We're going off tangent, but we have a new question, so that's very well timed.
Can I just respond to that? Because I said, can you just say the word you said this morning about we are all the human race? And I said, can I use that?
My question is more general about working together as a novelist and with historians. My dad's a historian, and he loves that I am interested in writing historical fiction, but he does this kind of look, you know, yes, you know, really. But he's the real historian, and it's, you know, what he does is real, and it's very, very nice what I'm interested in doing. But I was just wondering if, you know, and I'm sure there's a whole spectrum of historians that really look down their noses at fiction writers, and I was wondering if there was some kind of club or any tips you have for working together in a mutually respectful way.
Can I answer this? There are 1,000 different varieties of historians If you were telling someone you're a novelist and you didn't say that you were a historical novelist and they said, yes, my favourite fiction writer is Greg Egan, and you were saying, who's Greg Egan? You don't read science fiction. Why should you know who Greg Egan is? You're conflating all historians. There are 1,000 types of historians. Some cannot work with historical novelists because their history doesn't work for historical novelists. At the attitude thing, there are 1,000 different types of historians. They're all human beings. They all have attitudes.
Yeah. Ask your father about what are the most important moments in his life. I bet you that some of them I would suggest are very strong, like, say, maybe your birth. And then ask him to do the historical analysis of those, because I think we can get caught up. I think one of the things people will complain, like the Mary Bryant story, or whichever story you were taking. You know, someone did one recently coming back to the factory, and it was totally not the facts, but I came out crying. You know, and I'm reading the Mary Bryant story, which I know the story, and then I'm reading Fled, and I'm going, yeah.
But 95% of historians will not read historical novels because it's a different type of history. It's told differently. When you're in the branch of history that will read them, you're that 5%. And that's a really good 5% to be in, because it means you've got two types of narratives that overlap, that are comfortable together.
To finish that, I've loved every moment working with you.
I couldn't do it without you. But one thing that to do, if you need a historian to work with, or if you're looking to collaborate, is if you can identify someone who, like Gay, does what she does because she's passionate about the stories being told.
You find that overlap.
Yeah.
You find someone who shares what you want to do.
Yes, and I'm passionate about those stories as well, and that was our first point of connection, the fact that we were both passionate about the same stories. Mm. And once you find that, and, you know, as Gillian says, you're not going to find that in all historians, but if you find a historian who does share that little ember, you can build around that.
And it's creative thinking. I think you have to think creatively as an historian to piece together some of the histories as well. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of creative thinking
but
as
but
well.
That's actually not the cause of the difference. Look at, go into a library and find a random historical journal. My personal favourite is Rethinking History, because I'm an historiographer. Rethinking History gives you lots of lovely history theory. It tells you exactly how all your work, whether it's in one profession or another profession, the narratives produced by it can be analysed according to the latest in historical theory. You're not going to write really good novels from that. But you're going to find out that most of the historians who publish in historical theory, you're going to look at it and say, hang on, this one uses ordinary English. I can at least talk to them. There are two of us who are actual novelists who have been published in historical theory. We're the two you need to find, not every single historian who publishes there. There are some historical journals where you'll find nobody. Economic history is probably a good example. Nobody who thinks in the narrative terms that historical novelists need. There are 1,000 different types of historians, not 1,000 different historians. They're actual, think of genre of literature and then multiply them, because every single person has a minimum of a doctorate. And bunches of skills that are totally essential to bore into the primary sources and analyse them and look through 200 years of analysis on the same subject and set yourself up in relationship to other historians in the same field. And you're obsessed with your own field. You don't necessarily want to look outside your field. Historical novelists don't have that level of obsession. Novelists tell stories about people. The focus is on stories and people.
Mm. Yeah, and I become obsessed with... I happen to be very interested in colonial Australia, but what draws me to telling one story or over another is a fascination with the individuals.
So you need to find historians who can talk about human beings as if they're, you know, human beings. And not all historians can, and not all historians need to.
I'd like to add something else too. Sorry. Yeah, just that we get to know the novelist and all their personal context and all that. how much do we know about the story, and shouldn't we have their context as well so that we can put a history to it? So there is all, we always have, I come with a bias. I can, you know, I can share, I'll share my bias some other time, but you know, everyone comes with a bias. So how about making that plain so people can understand where it's coming from?
I hope you've enjoyed this discussion. If you would like to know more about the Historical Novel Society Australasia and our numerous activities to promote reading and writing historical fiction, please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au. There you'll also find full biographies of our podcast participants under the tab News and Interviews. I'm Greg Johnston, and thank you for listening to this podcast.